Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As forest fire season begins in South Dakota, expect to see more intensity in the years to come. That's according to our next guest. Mark Cochran is a senior scientist at the Geospatial Sciences Center of Excellence, and he's a professor at South Dakota State University. He joins us now from Brookings. Mark, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
All right, so help me help put in perspective, especially for South Dakotans who don't live West River and aren't as tuned in to what a forest fire season is and its implications. Just give us sort of an overview of why this is such an important conversation in our state.
Well, forest fire season is basically setting the conditions wherein you might have forest fires. So it's when, ideally, when things get dry and warm and windy. And when those conditions are together, that's when we have higher fire risk. So then when we do have a fire in those conditions, it's much more likely to get large and impact a lot of things of human values, be they houses, homes, or people.
And what sort of processes take place to make those predictions for this season?
Okay, well, one of the things is, you know, right now looking at our current drought situation and normal weather patterns. So trying to have an idea of what's coming in the short term, what we've been looking at more is trying to looking at trends over the longer term as well.
All right, let's talk about some of those longer term trends. What are you seeing?
Well, what we see globally is we have an increase in these conditions where we could have severe wildfires, and that's something we've seen before. What we've also done more recently is looked at not just the conditions, but where the very large extreme fires have been happening and how those have played out over time. And what we see with that is an increased chance of having these very large, what we call 99.997% events globally. But they don't happen just anywhere globally. We have them in all areas, but most of them have been concentrating either in the western U.S. or eastern Australia.
Can you give me an example of something that you looked at and what you learned?
Well, we basically we used satellite imagery to pick up the most intense and largest fires that have been seen since 2002. And then once we could say which ones they are, we went and actually pulled up the weather records from those fires to look at the conditions under which they happened. And then we looked at how that has been changing so that we can then project how these risks are likely to increase over the coming decades out to about 2040.
And how has it been changing?
Well, in these areas where we've seen the most fires, not too surprisingly, those risk levels are increasing. And so basically what we project is that by 2040, we're looking at about somewhere between 20 and 50% increase in the number of these very large disastrous fires that impact lots of people and homes.
All right. Tell me what that looks like in South Dakota by 2040, a 20 to 50% increase in larger fires. What's the potential, impact of that?
Well, the potential would be something like we had the Jasper fire back 2002 or so, with large fires like that basically are beyond anything we can control. So we're just left, to kind of try to get out of the way of these fires. It doesn't mean there definitely will be one happening. And, Black Hills has been trying to do things to help the conditions because it's not just the weather either. It's all the fuels. And so, as most people know, the hills have gotten a little bit overgrown in recent decades, and they've been working hard now to thin them down since the Jasper fire and try to help reduce that risk. But with ongoing mountain pine beetle, bug kill and everything, that just exacerbates the problem. And we have a lot of people moving out into these flammable landscapes now, so the risk levels are high just if there are no changing conditions. But we do know that over time we're looking at it getting warmer and drier, and it's always windy, so the chances of having these types of fires that impact people are increasing.
So climate conditions play the largest role?
Yeah, it's an interesting question to say the largest role. Yeah, on any one fire, and you can't really say that, I don't think, but okay. They're the one that's changing quickly now, relatively quickly. So we see this trend increasing over time. So even if you do things to manage the forest and try to keep it from getting overgrown, that risk is increasing. The other thing is we keep building houses in more of these areas, so that is also a huge part of the problem, because now we've got more people in areas at risk.
Let's go back to the notion of an overgrown forest and the bug kill exacerbating the problem. Mm-hmm. Help me figure that out, because I'm not quite making the connection.
Okay, yeah, I mean, for most people, it doesn't make sense right off the bat.
Right? Yeah, so, it's not intuitive necessarily.
The Black Hills, I mean, if you look at it, like George Custer was out there back in the 1800s when we took pictures, and you can see it was not as much forest cover as we have there now. And what has happened is in the Ponderosa Pine areas, at least, we got very good at preventing fires. Especially after 1910, we had a lot of problems and a lot of people died in those fires. So we got very serious about trying to stop fires. And so that seemed like a very good thing. And it saved a lot of people at that time. But if you stop the fires, that allows the trees to grow, which, again, seems like a good idea. But over time, that forest has grown thicker and thicker and really changed its character. Normally, a ponderosa pine forest is an open forest, like you could, ride your horses through it. There was grass underneath. So when you had a fire, it would burn the grass but not kill the trees. Now, as those forests have gotten, denser and denser, what we have are fires that now can move into the smaller trees and move up into the higher canopy and actually create canopy fires that are extremely intense and that will kill the trees and anybody else who gets caught in them. So the character of the fire has changed and the outcome has changed. It used to be you had frequent fires, but they didn't kill much of the trees. Now you have infrequent fires, but when they happen, you end up like the Jasper Fire, which you can drive through to this day, and it's a big area with almost no regrowing vegetation, or trees at least.
So how do we address concerns like that? What's currently being done with that awareness?
Well, one thing with that is in the hills, more than most places I've seen, they've really been trying to thin that forest. So out there you'll see a lot of the piles that they burn in the winter now, where they go through and they'll cut some of the smaller trees and they'll pile them up. And then when we have snow cover and they can burn them, they burn those out when it's safe. And so that is helping to open up that area, so it's less likely to have we call ladder fuels that allows it to get up into that canopy. So we're doing that to try to reduce the risk. Working against us, though, is things like mountain pine beetle, which is getting in there, and it's harder to manage as it's moving through these areas, and that's another kind of outcome of ongoing climate issues. It's always been there, but now with ongoing drought and such in warmer winters, what we have is more stressed trees and less likelihood of being able to kill the beetles off during the winter. So we have more of them around, killing more trees. That creates, more dry fuels that potentially can create bad fire conditions as well.
So what needs to happen in the, are there specific things that need to happen in the forest or beyond that are going to help start addressing this issue, or is it a done deal and this is just what's going to be the future?
Well, I mean, a lot of it's in motion. Things that we could do and we're trying to do is try to manage the landscape better. We got to also learn to deal with fire and live with it. Now we try to do prescribed fires and such, but nobody wants to deal with the smoke. People don't realize it's not a question of yes or no to fire. It's only a question of when you will have it. You can either do it under conditions that are somewhat manageable, or you can wait until the worst conditions, like something like the Jasper Fire, when you can't do anything to control it, and it is very dangerous. So that's one thing. People just have to learn to start living with fire again. Fire is not unnatural in these landscapes. It only seems that way because we've been able to control it for a number of decades. And as we see across the country now, we are not able to do that anymore. We're spending more and more every year, and the amount of area that's burning keeps going up. So we are losing that battle. We cannot prevent all those fires, so we're going to have to learn to deal with it better. So part of that is managing the fuels, like we're saying, but part of it is actually either having intentional fires, prescribed fires in areas, or allowing some areas to burn more naturally so that we will reduce the risk over time. We need to have more fires because, like, even if we look at this year, some of the fires, like Whitetail and everything, they were somewhat contained by previous wildfires where the fuels are lower and, they can either fight them or they don't spread as fast. So having some of those fires in the landscape actually protects the rest of the landscape. So we just need to start accepting wildfire as part of the natural system.
Are there health implications or economic implications of sort of living with fire more frequently that holds people back or provides a challenge?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the main one that people complain about isn't so much the fire as the smoke, because the smoke is, you know, it's not just an inconvenience for some people with respiratory problems. It can be life-threatening. So it's not a trivial matter by any means, but it's not something that you can definitively stop either. So that is, you know, I don't mean to trivialize those kinds of concerns. And anytime you even try to put a prescribed fire in place, a certain percentage of those are going to get away and destroy homes and have other problems as well. So it's not an easy thing, and this is why there is no easy solution.
How do the fires begin? Are they being started by humans accidentally? Are they from lightning? The sort of fires that are not prescribed or controlled burns?
Yeah, we have kind of the full suite. I mean, lightning is like your natural fire source that would cause fires regardless of humans. But humans tend to be the main source of these fires, you know, whether accidental, could be arson, could be escaped fires from trash burning. You know, we always have fires. So the more people we put on those landscapes, the more likelihood we're going to have fires as well.
So people need to stop moving there and building houses. How difficult is that kind of conversation to have about how many people should be inhabiting a forest scape like that?
Oh, very hard, especially here. I mean, we're ideas. You know, we have freedom to move places and do things. So I don't know if it has to be, you know, you can't go there. But part of it has to be, if you do go there, you have to manage your lands well so you don't, like, have trees dangling over your house and then expect somebody to come save your house when things are burning. So yeah, we have ideas of kind of fire-safe landscaping or building, you know, your construction, your materials. You can do things to make your house more survivable. You can actually move out of the way when fires are coming. I personally think that insurance should pick up some of this, but I've talked to insurance companies and they can't be bothered. But just like if you live in a floodplain, that's fine. You can live there, but you're going to pay the cost in terms of insurance or losing your home. Well, same thing should be if you're in these landscapes. You have the right to live in those places, but you should have to pay for that privilege.
Let's talk a little bit about, as we sort of embark on this season in South Dakota, it happened last year when I was here. It happens every year. You know, there are going to be fires. What are the questions we need to ask when there is a fire? And, how closely do we follow it? And what are the things that we can learn and need to know each time it happens over the season?
Well, I mean, one of the things, like I said, is, you know, fire, like, it's there every year. So that's not unusual. I mean, the questions for people personally is, like, how close is it to where I'm at? What are the conditions right now? Is it an extreme drought? Are they predicting high winds, especially in the direction of my home or where I live? And listen to what, you know, the authorities are telling you in terms of that risk, because what one moment can look like a fairly well-behaved fire and the smoke is in the distance can very quickly become extremely dangerous, as we saw in the east just November, the Gallatin fire, which, you know, burned several homes and killed many people. So it can change very quickly.
What's the impact on wildlife?
Well, the impact on wildlife initially looks bad in the sense that you burn this forest and it, I mean, but for wildlife that's been there, it's not bad at all. They're very well adapted to it. So while you will lose maybe some deer or a few things initially if they couldn't escape that fire, usually what happens is shortly after the fire, they return and do much better. And if you don't have this, you actually start losing a lot of the native wildlife that are in those areas.
How come?
Because most wildlife is designed to have, say, a patchwork of different ecosystem types, or even more open forest, more closed forest, grasslands and such. Well, if you keep fire out, it eventually all becomes a very thick, unnatural forest for them, so they're going to move out of that area because that's not what they're used to living in, shall we say. Whereas if it has a certain patchwork of this burning over time, it becomes a better habitat for most of the wildlife that is endemic to the area.
So, and I feel like, and if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Mark Cochran. He's a senior scientist at the Geospatial Sciences Center of Excellence. He's a professor at South Dakota State University, and I'm sort of asking him every question I've always wanted to know about fire because, you know, I'm an East River resident, and I remember last season it was all kind of a mystery to me, and I didn't really fully understand the impact and the importance of this conversation. So I appreciate you letting me ask you all the basic questions. Are you learning things from other communities that we can put to use here in South Dakota?
Communities. I mean, yeah, every place has different traits, like whether it's Southern California or, you know, Eastern U.S. You know, Eastern U.S., they don't think fire should be a problem at all. They're normally not, but this last year they suddenly were. Or you see odd behaviors where, I don't know, in the Chaparral, you know, over in California, if it burns one year, that's where people don't want to live. They're going to move into the thick, deep Chaparral, which is actually where they're going to get burned out the coming years.
Right, okay.
So people are averse to what happened last year instead of thinking what might happen next year. In fact, if you're in an area that burned recently, and, you know, building your house there might be the best idea because it's, you know, it's going to start recovering there, but it's less likely to have severe fires in the near future.
How long does it take to recover?
Can you
help it recover in a way? I mean, is that a moment of opportunity there after a fire?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I guess it depends how you define recover. As an ecosystem, it's probably going to be fine. Eventually, it kind of depends on how it burned. Like the Jasper area, that burned so severely that it is unnaturally open now, and it may take a very long time for the ponderosa pine to seed back in there because it'll need some really wet years to allow them to establish and start growing. But if you're in an area that burned, you know, less severely, you know, it can take decades for it to kind of get back to where it was, which is a good thing for you because that means a lot of the lower vegetation has been burned out, and therefore your fire risk, while not zero, is much lower. There's less chance of the fire going through there, and if it does, it's going to be less intense and therefore, you know, less likely to destroy your home or cause other problems like that.
Were there management issues in Jasper that caused it to be as destructive as it was? And I don't know much about it other than I remember the loss of lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's the basic management, if you will, was the fact that we were so successful in stopping fire for several decades. You know, we were a victim of our own success in that regard.
And how long does it take before it recovers?
It won't recover without the fire, but the problem is, how do you put the fire back in the landscape? Because if you try to put the fire back in under, you know, severe conditions, you end up destroying the forest. Mm-hmm. So trying to get back to where it was is a difficulty that people are still trying to solve. We do it now by trying to, you know, mechanically thin some of these areas or trying to do prescribed fires under, you know, more controllable conditions, but it's fraught with a lot of risk because any prescribed fire is only as good as the weather prediction. So,
right.
And we know that the weather is sometimes not what they told us it was going to be, right?
Right.
So,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was saying so that, you know, that makes it difficult to do. And it's not necessarily back to where it was, and it has to be a long-term commitment to do these kind of things in order to keep moving it back into the condition it was. So it's not something, it's not like one and done. You don't just treat it and walk away from it and everything's good. This is something you're going to have to do over the long haul. If you want to replace fire on that landscape, it won't be exact, but it is an ongoing cost that you have to maintain it. You know, everything keeps growing back. So if you're thinning it, you have to keep going back every several years and thin it again.
How did you get interested in all this? What sort of drew you to this path?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Over time, I know you can start back from when I was 11 years old and we had a fire behind my house and I went out and helped fight it and do that, you know, as best I could with my sneakers. But I got paid for it, so I was a volunteer. To any number of things. I've worked all around the world now on these issues, from the Amazon to Indonesia to Australia, you know, and seen so many areas and seen how they, as well as Black Hills,
right.
how they react and how they are different. I mean, fire is universal, but it's different everywhere we are.
Unfortunately, you have job security in a sense. What do you love about your job?
Well, I love being able to ask the questions and then, you know, try to answer them. Granted, I have to go find somebody who's willing to fund me while I try to figure out the answers. But I do have the freedom to ask those questions and see where they lead me.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mark. Some of my questions were basic, but I learned a lot today. Any final thoughts, a more sophisticated question that you think people need to understand to leave us with?
Well, just the one that realized that things are changing over time, and they're probably not changing in a direction people want. Mm-hmm. So that risk is going to increase over time, so people should be thinking about how they want to manage either their landscapes or their lives to account for it.
Mark Cochran is a senior scientist at the Geospatial Sciences Center of Excellence. He's a professor at South Dakota State University. Thank you so much, Mark, for being here.
You're welcome.